You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme... Rival protesters scuffle in Ukraine's Crimea region while Russian President Vladimir Putin orders a test of combat readiness of his troops. I'll be discussing the latest in Ukraine with John Everard and Peter York. We'll also look at China's economic performance as the country's central bank gives its first official statement on the sudden weakening of the yuan. And we'll also be discussing the latest developments in North Korea. Then it is almost carnival time. We'll find out what Brazilians believe makes the ideal mask.
The masks represent what the country has been discussing. So there's a lot of times it can be quite political. But at the same time, we have years that were a bit lighter. So for example, we have TV stars like Chiazinha.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. And before the end of the programme, we'll also have our weekly review of the best television from around the world. Today, we're in the US to discuss the serial killer thriller for people who don't actually like serial killer thrillers.
There's a feeling, you might notice it sometime, this feeling like life has slipped through your fingers.
All that, plus a check-in with our man in San Francisco, Alistair G, and a bit of music too, I promise. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. And before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Ukraine's acting general prosecutor Oleh Makhinsky has announced that ousted President Viktor Yanukovych has been put on the international wanted list and is wanted for mass murder connected with the shooting deaths of protesters during the crisis. Mr. Yanukovych was ousted by Parliament on Saturday after 3 months of street unrest and has gone into hiding. His whereabouts are not known, although the government says it believes he's hiding in Crimea. It wants him tried at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. In other developments, US Deputy Secretary of State William Burns has visited Ukraine and promised to help the country's new government.
The first step, again, is the formation of a new government and an opportunity to sit down with that new government and identify the plans of the new Ukrainian government, their diagnosis of the problem, and then identify specifically what we can do to help. And we'll be ready to do that along with the EU and the IMF.
And in Russia, President Vladimir Putin has put combat troops on high alert for a drill, the Kremlin's most powerful gesture yet, after days of saber-rattling since Mr. Yanukovych was toppled. Forces loyal to Syria's president have killed at least 175 Islamist rebel fighters, most of them foreigners, in an ambush in insurgent-held eastern outskirts of Damascus. The attack was led by the Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah, which has joined the government in an increasingly sectarian conflict that's pulling in fighters from across the region and destabilizing Syria's neighbors, according to activists. In London, a judge at the Old Bailey has sentenced one of the two men who murdered soldier Lee Rigby in May last year to spend the rest of his life in prison. Sentencing the killers in their absence, Mr. Justice Sweeney said they had both been convicted on overwhelming evidence of the barbaric murder of Fusilier Rigby. 29-year-old Michael Adebolajo received the whole life term, while 22-year-old Michael Adebowale was ordered to serve at least 45 years. The pair were absent during sentencing after a scuffle in the dock. The captain of the wrecked Costa Concordia cruise liner, Francisco Cettino, has visited Giglio Island for the first time since the fateful accident that led to the deaths of 32 people. He faces multiple charges, including manslaughter, causing a shipwreck, and abandoning ship after the Concordia, carrying more than 4,000 passengers and crew, slammed into the rocks off Giglio Island in January 2012. And Italian Navy and Coast Guard officials say they've rescued some 500 migrants from seas off Italy in the last 24 hours. Navy vessels operating off the coast of Sicily intercepted three dinghies packed with more than 90 migrants each in the early hours of this morning. In another rescue, Coast Guard patrols picked up 218 migrants from one 18-metre boat, which had run into trouble off the coast of Lampedusa. And a former chief editor of a major Hong Kong newspaper known for its critical reporting has been injured in a frenzied attack. The assault is likely to cause concern among journalists over what many see as an erosion of media freedoms. The man, Kevin Lau, former chief editor of the Ming Pao Daily, was ambushed as he got out of his car this morning. Superintendent Simon Kwan briefed reporters.
Suddenly, two suspects, they drove and arrived and parked the motorcycle in front of the private car. One of them alighted from the motorcycle and used a chopper and attacked the victims. And as a result, the victims suffered from three cut wounds, one at his back and two at his legs.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James Luckhurst, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti cheche.
From London,
London, caralho.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 18.06 here in London and 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is the author and commentator Peter York and John Everard, a former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, both Monocle 24 regulars. Peter, John, welcome to the show. We're going to start by talking about the latest events in Ukraine. There were protests today in Crimea as pro-Russian demonstrators clashed with around 20,000 Muslim Tatars who had been rallying in support of Ukraine's pro-European interim government. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an immediate test of combat readiness of his troops in central and western Russia, probably just posturing, but it underscores just how precarious, John Everard, the situation remains.
Well, it is indeed precarious. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that the snap military exercises are indeed just posturing. I don't think there is that much chance that Putin is going to start sending tanks in. That would be just so 20th century. There are other ways of exerting influence over Ukraine and other ways of trying to swing things his way. It's very important when we talk about possible separatist tendencies in the Ukraine, particularly in Crimea, to understand that Crimea itself is split. It wouldn't just go off as a lump one way or the other. There are a lot of people in Crimea who feel passionately that they belong to Ukraine, not to Russia. The Tatars, the Crimean Cossacks, an awful lot of native Ukrainian-speaking people who are clearly at loggerheads with the Russophone elements in Crimea. And I think today's demonstrations, rival demonstrations, neatly symbolise that. It's a very, very complex situation.
Peter, a very, very complex situation, as John Everard says there. I mean, when you look at Vladimir Putin's position in all this, obviously he's just had Sochi, and what he was hoping was going to be a wonderful soft power success for him as the world turns its attention to his sort of personal prestige project. And yet now he finds himself in a slightly different situation, doesn't he?
Well, there's this great reverse. And he's sort of become a figure of fun in the West. And people are saying, look, what's the Russian economy worth? You know, there's oil and gas. As people become self-sufficient, he's betted the farm on oil and gas. There's nothing else there. And of course, we little British people feel particularly vociferous about that after his spokesman dissed us, you know, in the way, you know, it's just London, it's just a place that my friends own.
And talk about Britain's small island.
Well, see you.
Indeed. I mean, there is, yeah. John, isn't it? This sort of, if you like, you know, he this caricature of the way that Putin is seen in the West. And yet there's also, at the same time as this sort of caricature of him being this slight peculiar figure, he is also seen as a powerful leader. Now, is the real Putin perhaps somewhere between those two?
I think he's much more towards the powerful leader end of that spectrum. He is decisive, he knows exactly what he wants, and he's utterly ruthless. He cannot afford to let Ukraine slip away from the Russian orbit. Particularly, he cannot afford to let Crimea do that. Crimea is the base for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, one of the most useless fleets in the world, and a very expensive military toy. It can't actually go anywhere. But in terms of Putin's prestige, it is vital, and he can't let it go. I'm so glad that Peter pointed to the economics of this. The amounts of money that are going to be required to stabilise Ukraine are jaw-dropping. The interim government is talking about $35 billion cash now. I mean, even in terms of national economies, this is an enormous amount of money. And I think that one of the difficult areas of this for Putin is that as he talks to people he still likes to call Western partners, we haven't actually got down to acrimonious rhetoric yet, about who is going to pay what for Ukraine, it is going to become painfully apparent that Russia is broke and that the money is going to have to come from the West. Now, this is important because in these situations, people who pay in most tend to effectively buy the greatest influence in the newly stabilized state.
Well, as John says, people who pay in most tend to get more influence. But do you think, Peter York, that the West is going to be keen to dip its hand into its pocket? Because, as John says, these are vast sums, and the EU's talking about, well, maybe we can find 20 billion euros, but, that'll be over a period of time, and obviously not all up front, and America's not about to get out its checkbook straight away, is it?
No, but I think it's got more hope of doing a sort of risk-spreading and back-passing exercise that just gets it done than Russia has in its current state. What I don't understand is, well, here is saber rattling, as we used to call it on the Barson. And anybody who's got any memory of what the Soviets used to do with dissenting client states gets sort of nervous. How far are they prepared to go?
Well, as I say, I don't think that they are going to send in tanks. If you do get to that scenario and it came to a military conflict between, inevitably, there'll be a NATO countermarch to a Russian intervention, NATO's going to win. It's as simple as that. The Russian armed forces are very antiquated. Their tanks creak badly. They're undertrained. And they're no longer any match for a sizable Western force. But I don't think it will come to that. I think it will come down to cajoling, bribery, storming fits in international fora,
or diplomacy, as we like to call it.
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's another word for it, yes.
John, you've said that you feel that Putin is more the powerful leader than the sort of the funny caricature, and yet you've also just said Russia's broke, yeah, and that in any war Russia would lose.
That's right. The powerful leader, and he has to portray himself as such to maintain his popular base. In terms of Russian domestic politics, remember, this is a man whose re-election to power was fiercely fought, and a lot of Russians still think he cheated. He needs to Russians to believe that he is the powerful national leader who will make Russia walk tall in the international arena. Now, he had a good 2013. He pulled off this stunt over Syria, which in many ways was actually Putin walking into an American bear trap, but that's another story. In Russian terms, that looked good. So far, 2014 has been disastrous for him. The whole the collapse of his puppet client state in Ukraine simply was not meant to happen, and it's not at all clear that he has any sensible plan for how to deal with it.
Peter York, any client state needs a client leader, and you had a great fun over the weekend delving into the wonderful pictures that were coming out of, or the wonderfully bizarre pictures that were coming out of Viktor Yanukovych's rather strange and opulent lifestyle. What do you feel that what we discovered about Yanukovych says about the leaders that Ukraine has had?
Well, it says they've had their hand in the till in a big way. I hadn't quite clocked that the Ukraine was a place where you could do that, but clearly it is, because that place was recently constructed and apparently at a cost of 300. And there is every sign of a Ceausescu-like life having gone on there in all its glory and bathos. So I think that for the people, you know, the people who are on that side, will be a powerful inducement. It's become a sort of Disneyland of the revolution. I think it's always astonishing to me that you can't actually shame a leader amongst people who really care for him. You do that. It's like Adam Clayton Powell. This is going back and back and back. That they show the people who are hated. Adam Clayton Powell was a black senator of a long time ago. And they showed that he was living at the high up the hog. But the black vote, the black supporters didn't change at all. But the rest of us, we think, what a terrible person.
Not just the rest of us outside. I think it's quite clear that the opulence of Yanukovych's private domestic arrangements has really shocked Ukrainians of whatever persuasion. This raises, if I can, another aspect of this, that, of course, not just Ukrainians are watching what happens over this. Belarusians are as well, and Russians. Mm-hmm. And Yanukovych isn't the only authoritarian leader in the region to have spent vast amounts of public money on fitting out his own palaces. And that's there's going to be anger around.
Yeah, indeed. Let's move on to another leader, not in the Russian sphere, but in the arguably in the communist sphere, who I'm fairly sure has got gold-plated, monogrammed golf clubs, and that's at Kim Jong-un in North Korea. We saw this week family members separated by the war between North and South Korea, saying their final goodbyes after the last round of these rather rare reunions. On the very same day, officials in Seoul said that a North Korean patrol boat had violated the border with the South several times. This comes at a time where we've got these joint military drills between the US and South Korea, which obviously Pyongyang isn't a fan of. John, there's a lot to unpack here. There's, in a sense, progress because there's these reunions, and yet there's also, you know, to go back to that phrase, more saber rattling. How do you judge the events of the last few days?
I think that we've seen really substantial progress. The reunions went well. There was no big interference, and crucially, they were not curtailed. There were some concerns that the North Koreans would only allow them to run up to the start of the US-South Korean joint military exercises. In fact, they let them run right to the end. I think the incursion across the maritime, the limit line, was simply the North showing it wasn't going to take the exercise lying down. It had to do something. But that was a kind of minimalist response. No shots were fired. And although the South Korean vessels had to shout at it, I think 10 warnings were issued before it retreated. It did, in the end, retreat. And the North Koreans doubtless will portray this internally as a heroic act defying the imperialist puppets. The problem is a bit further down the line. The reason that Kim Jong-un is being so, quote, nice, unquote, to the South right now is because he's not getting the support he needs from China. And for years, North Korea has played China off against South Korea. So he cuddles up to South Korea. He's going to want a lot of South Korean tangible support at some point. And it's not at all clear he's going to get that. The big question mark is, what does Kim Jong-un do when he finds he's not getting the aid he needs either from China or from South Korea? And it's in those situations that North Korea can get desperate and lash out.
And Peter York, I mean, that is the big question, isn't it? What happens if North Korea can't rely on the Chinese?
Well, I mean, I don't know. How long is that economic model sustainable without a lot of support like that? You would think it would implode. And I don't know, what lashing out can they do?
Well, in 2010, they sank a South Korean corvette.
Yes.
Shelled a South Korean island. North Korea has a long track record of armed provocations against people it doesn't like.
And we're going to, because everything is seamlessly linked today, we're going to come on to other governments as well, which have certain models, and we'll look at whether they can be sustainable. We're with Peter York and John Everard. It's Midori House. We're going to be back with more after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist.
We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24, 1821 here in London, 1321 on the east coast of the US. We've got John Everard here, former UK ambassador, and the author and commentator Peter York. We're going to turn now to Venezuela, which is experiencing its worst anti-government protests in a decade. Even Pope Francis has now called for a cease of violence and hostilities. John Everard, you've worked in Latin America. We've been discussing governments that maybe will struggle to last the way they're run at the moment. Nicolas Maduro and his the Bolivarian revolution that he's inherited from Hugo Chavez, is he in trouble?
Well, the leader of the opposition, Capriles, has said that he thinks the government is on its last legs. He's in trouble. He doesn't appear to have any sensible response to the protests that we've been watching for a week now, and you know, where various people have been killed. And apart from trying to blame the United States, there's no evidence outside the slightly paranoid ambiance of Caracas.
Well, this time there's no evidence. I mean, part of the reason why, as you say, they might be slightly paranoid is because in previous times the US has been involved.
Yes, but not this time. The United States has, in the past has become deeply involved in the internal affairs of Latin American countries, but things have moved on since then. And just like, was it yesterday or today, the United States has expelled three Venezuelan diplomats, just to a tit-for-tat expulsion for the three that Venezuela threw out. But Maduro, it's important to remember that the protests are largely about shortages, inflation, and economic issues. And Maduro has no answer to these problems. And even though the current wave of protests look like they're calming down a bit, there will be recurrences. And eventually, he's going to find the place to be almost ungovernable.
Peter York, when you look at the situation in Venezuela, it hasn't had as much coverage over the past week or so as Ukraine, because we've all been focused on the East and very little on the West. Why do you think there's sort of less appetite for what's going on in Venezuela?
Well, there's less appetite in UK and European media generally for South American news than obviously European news of any kind. There's very little reporting here of South American stuff. There's a bit of exotica about Cuba because we like the idea of Cuba. I'm trying to think of anything really major and consistent outside the really specialist foreign pages. This never makes front page.
And John, are you surprised by the fact that for something on at this moment, I mean, obviously there have been the events in Ukraine and often it's, I know news editors think, well, there's only one foreign crisis we can cover at one time.
Yes, I think there are elements of that, and I think it's a great pity. Of course, Ukraine is extremely important, but so is what is going on in South America. And it's not just Venezuela. I mean, just today, Correa, the president of Ecuador, who you recall, has just lost Quito, his capital, to the opposition in the local elections, has said that he's not sure that Ecuador is any longer governable. You see, in South America, you've got this kind of, what do you call it, clique, group, whatever, of slightly idiosyncratic leaders in Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, and, as Peter rightly says, in Cuba. Venezuela and Ecuador are both wobbling badly. Cuba is in deep trouble anyway because economic expectations have risen far faster than the, albeit reformist, government is able to deliver. And I think there are open questions about how long any of these countries can hold to their present path.
I want to just quickly touch on China. There's been issues this week over the Chinese economy. The renminbi has slid for its seventh day in a row. That's its lowest level since early August. Before we come on to the specifics of that, John, Peter York, I just want to ask you about the influx of Chinese and Russian money that we've seen here in London. If China and Russia are in a bit of trouble, some people in London would say, "Oh God, well, that's going to be terrible for us because all this money comes in here." But is it actually necessarily a bad thing if there are less oligarchs and less of their Chinese counterparts spending their billions here?
It's one of the biggest stories in the world, and still not sufficiently covered. What has happened to London as this extraordinary city-state that we've got, the world's top dog city at the moment? It is. And a lot of that is about flight capital and very dodgy money. Of course, if things go wrong in China and in Russia, it might mean that there was more of it. More flight, more to flee from, more dodgy money being let in because we are the world's biggest tax haven. And yes, it is peculiar. It's a very, very difficult thing for any thinking British politician to make his mind up about, because people are scared of letting the global rich take their ball somewhere else.
The global rich, John Everard, at the moment still includes the Chinese.
It still includes the Chinese. I'm glad that Peter pointed out the risks to what's going on in London of things going wrong in Russia or in China. In Russia, things are already going wrong, even before Russia pays bills on the Ukraine. The central bank has been intervening to the tune of $400 million a day just to support the ruble. Now, this is not a happy country, not a happy economy. The interesting thing about the slide of the renminbi is that this wasn't supposed to happen, that everybody expected that following the change of monetary policy back in 2005, that we'd see this steady appreciation of the Chinese currency against the dollar, which goes some way to assuaging US concerns that the Chinese are cheating effectively by undervaluing their currency and making their exports too competitive. This is just a symptom. There are deep underlying causes for this fall, including massively inflated banking figures, lots and lots of very bad loans, and this incredibly complex web of interconnections between Chinese leaders that makes bringing anybody to account for economic malpractice extremely difficult.
We're going to leave it there. I just want to ask Peter York one final thing, which is about the Oscars this weekend. They're on Sunday night, and it's an interesting Oscars night this year, isn't it? Because we've actually got not just very good films, but very popular films that lots of people have seen. A lot of people yes. go, oh, actually, I've seen lots of these, rather than sometimes you're like, really, that?
And quite a lot of films made by or involving little British people.
Well, I think that's pushing it, really, isn't it?
Well, there we are.
Steve McQueen, yes, but I mean...
But Steve McQueen and the Gravity, which is sort of a little British people picture.
I think that's pushing it, Gravity.
Well, a British producer, British effects, made in Britain very substantially. Yeah.
Is there anything in particular you think will be worth watching for this weekend?
Well, I don't know whether people are going to make speeches saying the British are coming, or we're here, or we're almost here, or we blew it. Or anything. But okay. It's very, very nice. On the Vanity Fair Hollywood cover, where three actors, two of them black, both of the black ones as British as could be. It was quite an interesting cover for that reason.
It was indeed. Peter York and John Everard, thank you both for joining me here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Or London.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots still to come here on Midori House. We'll be talking carnival in Brazil and mask trends there, would you believe? We'll also get the week's television news. And there'll be a couple of other things as well. Yes, we'll be in San Francisco. But before that, here is James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
Ukraine's acting general prosecutor Oleh Makhinsky has announced that ousted President Viktor Yanukovych has been put on the international wanted list and is wanted for mass murder connected with the shooting deaths of protesters during the crisis. Mr. Yanukovych was ousted by Parliament on Saturday after 3 months of street unrest and has gone into hiding. His whereabouts are not known, although the government says it believes he's hiding in Crimea. It wants him tried at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin has put combat troops on high alert for a drill, the Kremlin's most powerful gesture yet after days of saber-rattling since Mr. Yanukovych was toppled. Forces loyal to Syria's president have killed at least 175 Islamist rebel fighters, most of them foreigners, in an ambush in insurgent-held eastern outskirts of Damascus. The attack was led by the Lebanese Shiite militant group Hezbollah, which has joined the government in an increasingly sectarian conflict that's pulling in fighters from across the region and destabilizing Syria's neighbors, according to activists. In London, a judge at the Old Bailey has sentenced one of the two men who murdered soldier Lee Rigby in May last year to spend the rest of his life in prison. Sentencing the killers in their absence, Mr. Justice Sweeney said they'd been convicted on overwhelming evidence of the barbaric murder of Fusilier Rigby. 29-year-old Michael Adebalajo received the whole life term, while 22-year-old Michael Adebowale was ordered to serve at least 45 years. The captain of the wrecked Costa Concordia cruise liner, Francisco Cettino, has visited Giglio Island for the first time since the fateful accident that led to the deaths of 32 people. He faces multiple charges, including manslaughter, causing a shipwreck and abandoning ship after the Concordia, carrying more than 4,000 passengers and crew, slammed into the rocks off Giglio Island in January 2012. And Italian Navy and Coast Guard officials say they've rescued some 500 migrants from seas off Italy in the last 24 hours. Navy vessels operating off the coast of Sicily intercepted three dinghies packed with more than 90 migrants each in the early hours of Wednesday morning. In another rescue, Coast Guard patrols picked up 218 migrants from an 18-metre boat which had run into trouble off the coast of Lampedusa. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House, just gone the bottom of the hour. Thank you very much to James Luckhurst with the news. We head now to San Francisco to speak to Alistair G for Our Man In. We're going all the way to California. Alistair, welcome to Midori House. What do you have for us today?
Hi, Steve. Thanks very much. Well, the first bit of news is some relatively zany news that Tim Draper, a noted venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, is proposing that California be split into six states. So this guy, he's famous for investments in companies like Skype and Hotmail, but he's turning his hand to politics now and says that, in his view, California, as it is right now, is ungovernable. The state's comprised of a number of very different communities, and that's coming up clearly, for instance, in issues to do with the state's drought, which is the worst in its history, and you have the often Republican farming communities of the Central Valley taking issue with the actions of the Democrats up in Northern California. So Draper says that the state should be divided into six and is actually going about collecting signatures so he can put this on the ballot. And of these six states, the state of West California, for example, would include Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, while up here in San Francisco, I would be in the state of Silicon Valley, which includes this city and San Jose, and far north, for instance, we'd have the state of Jefferson. And yet he's totally serious. He gave a press conference this week at which the Chronicle quotes him as saying that each of these six new states can, quote, create a fresh start and best practices. So if one state has a really good idea, it can proliferate and they can all have a prospect for growth and prosperity.
Now, despite the fact that California does like its referenda, you never know, he might get enough signatures to get this on a ballot. This does strike me as the sort of thing that the richer parts of California might be quite happy about, but the poorer parts less so.
Well, exactly. I think you raise a good point there. The San Jose Mercury News actually quotes a political expert who says that the inhabitants of the new state of Central California, for one, would live in a state that probably has the highest poverty rate in the country. So obviously this would not suit everyone.
Indeed. I mean, as silly as this is, it does kind of draw attention to disparities within California. How much of an issue is this at the political level? I mean, Governor Jerry Brown talking about some of these big issues of inequality within California?
Well, I think those kinds of issues are always of concern to the leadership. Although I would say that I haven't come across much support for this plan specifically, and you referenced, I imagine it might be tough for him to get the signatures he needs and then the votes he needs and then the backing of of Congress to make it happen. I mean, you see political representatives saying things like six Californias is a foolhardy plan, It's while I think you're right to point out that the broader issues that Tim Draper is pointing out are of course of concern, I'm not sure he's going about addressing it in the most sensible way, perhaps.
Now, California was mooted by many people in the past as a place that could have some real solar power solutions for America and indeed for beyond. It's something that we've looked at in the magazine as well with stories that you've written. It looks, however, now as if the solar power plant industry is in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, well, when I reported on this for the magazine back in 2010, people were talking about the desert region in the southwestern US as being the Saudi Arabia of solar, owing to the amount of sunlight it receives. And some 220 power plants at the time I wrote the story had been proposed for the Mojave and Sonoran deserts, and 14 of them were fast-tracked through the planning process and were in the running for economic stimulus funding. And I also spoke to the head of the Public Works Department in Los Angeles, and he had a very grandiose vision. He said that he was so hoping for something akin to Silicon Valley in the desert. He called it the Solar Valley. And now the reality, it seems, is quite different, as you mentioned. The report, it seems that the age of huge solar power plants covering the desert may not happen. And we should start off by acknowledging that the support for them was never actually universal. There were fears in particular that not only would these plants mar a pristine habitat, but that they would disturb the desert tortoise in particular, which would have had to have been moved and its territory disrupted whenever someone wanted to build a plant. But now there are other problems. The New York Times notes that incentives for these large solar farms are starting to evaporate and that the appetite among investors for such massive projects has fallen. And the LA Times actually has a fascinating statistic. It says that while there have been 365 applications with the federal government to build these solar plants since 2009, only 20 are still in the pipeline.
Wow. Okay, that's quite a difference. And finally, let's talk about Google Glass, which I've got to say I've never liked the idea of. And it seems that as more San Franciscans come into contact with Google Glass, they're not too keen on it either.
Yeah, there are examples of what we might call a modest backlash against the device. Most recently, a San Francisco woman says she was attacked in a bar here because she was wearing the glass. She says she was taunted by a group of people, one of whom grabbed the device off her face, and that her purse and phone were then stolen. And yes, there's also a group on the internet called Stop the Cyborg, and they're offering Google Glass ban signs that business owners can then put up to signify that the devices are not welcome in their establishments.
And what is it that is putting people off, that makes them frustrated about the fact that there are these people walking around with Google Glass?
Well, I think private citizens have one set of concerns, and that's largely to do with privacy and whether or not people are recording them without their permission. There's another concern at the state and law enforcement level. Reuters is reporting that 8 US states are considering restricting Google Glass because there are concerns over whether the technology might distract people while driving and increase the likelihood of accidents. And it reports that Google is now fighting back in those states and is sending in lobbyists to persuade lawmakers that the device is not, in fact, a problem for drivers.
Okay, Alistair G in San Francisco, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We will be heading back to the US or discussing more US things when we do a review of the latest TV shows coming out of America. That is a little later. We're back after this.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monaco shop.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Brazil is getting ready for one of the biggest celebrations in the country. It's not the World Cup. Oh no, that's later. It's Carnival. And Brazilians are, as you would imagine, rather concerned about their outfits and in particular their mask, because just choosing the mask is a rather serious business. Each year, Brazilians wear different masks of famous faces, from politicians to TV stars, and you never know, there are always a few surprises. Our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco is a mask expert. Oh yes, he is. And he explained what his country is getting ready for this year.
I was reading actually a story on Folha de São Paulo, and they did this special, which we're going to discuss in a minute, that it is a millionaire industry in Brazil. Because every carnival, of course, we're discussing later, you've been to Brazil during carnival, not everybody wears masks, but it is a big part of what people wear during the street. So basically, the masks represent what the country has been discussing. So there's a lot of times it can be quite political. So sometimes, I mean, I'm going to discuss this later, but we had masks of President Lula, President Dilma, and also for some corrupt politicians, you know, so it's just some sort of protest. But at the same time, we have years that we're a bit lighter. So, for example, we have TV stars like Tiazinha.
Okay, so let's begin. If we kind of go back, and as you say, this Folha de São Paulo piece has kind of charted the history of the mask. If we go back to the 90s, let's pick some of the iconic masks of that period. Pick one that you found interesting from that period.
Let's do the first one, this chronological chart, which is 95, which was when Fernando Henrique Cardoso was elected. I mean, he was elected in 94, and it was quite a big change for Brazil. I mean, he was not our first democratic president, but it was the first time we had like a... how can I say? Because before we used to have Fernando Collor, which had an impeachment. So Fernando Henrique was quite... Brazilians were very hopeful about him when he was elected. So of course everybody wore his mask, and that was quite interesting.
Eu criei o Real e comecei sua implantação. Defendo o Real desde o início, enfrentando críticas e problemas de todo tipo. Agora, tem gente que torce visivelmente para que o Real dê errado.
I would like to talk about 99, if you don't mind. There was a character, a TV character called Tiazinha on TV, which is the little auntie. Basically, she was like a TV persona, TV model, and she was wearing lingerie. And it was a program for teenagers. That was the funny thing. And basically, she was going to wax the man if they don't get the right answer. So, for example, she'd say, what's the capital of Holland? If they get it wrong, she definitely waxed them. And she was wearing like a strip on her eyes. So she has like some kind of look, like a catwoman with less clothes. So that was quite an exotic side of Brazil for you. That was 99.
Shall we go on and maybe one that's perhaps quite contentious, and what you're saying is that the Brazilians perhaps like to make light of a certain situation. If we look that in 2002, Osama bin Laden was actually the most popular mask. Perhaps in the West or in Europe and in America, there was a lot of taboo around impersonating Osama bin Laden and certainly wearing a mask of him. That changed somewhat. But you kind of remember that? Is that a phenomenom? Talk a bit about that.
And you're right about this thing that Brazilians kind of, especially when it's something that happens outside Brazil, they take very lightly. I mean, what Osama bin Laden did, I mean, was horrible. But actually, as you can see, was the most popular mask in 2002. And from what I can remember, this time I was still living in Brazil, I don't think they did like some sort of protest about, I don't know, the Middle East or the US economy. It was kind of, some people said, oh, it's kind of a funny thing, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, there was a lot of jokes about it. So you're right about this things lightly. But even though in 2003, I think then people took a little bit more seriously. In 2003, the most popular mask was of George W. Bush, because let's remind, that was the year where the Iraq war started. I do think that in 2003, Brazilians were more critical about the way the Americans behaved. There was a rising tide of anti-Americanism in the country, which after Obama was elected, I think in most countries, it was almost over, I have to say.
So if we keep going, charting the history of Brazil through masks, we have Lula, obviously. Perhaps not. That's not a surprise. We can imagine he was a breath of fresh air, a shift to the left.
Hugely charismatic.
And perhaps not such a surprise. If we go jump to more recent times, the last few years, what's been going on in the last few years?
Again, very political. Well, first of all, 2011, the most popular one was Dilma Rousseff. Not a surprise there, she was elected president, the first female president. A lot of hope. But if you go 2 years ahead, then you have a guy like Joaquim Barbosa as the most popular mask. He's the Supreme Court judge who judged the politicians who were involved in the Mensalão scandal, the big allowance scandal, which is one of the biggest corruption cases in Brazilian history. And so people are quite serious. And actually, some people say that if he wanted to become the candidate for president, he might even win. I mean, he will not. He just said that in an interview, but I'm just saying that he's very popular and he got in the mood of the country, which was very angry about corruption and everything. And actually, this year, David, that it's interesting because they did like, who is going to be the mask of 2014? Nobody knows yet, but there's some options, which I'm going to tell you now. One is Amarildo. For those who don't know, Amarildo was a guy, he was arrested by the police in June and suddenly he disappeared. Nobody have ever heard of him. So he became an icon against police violence and how, because, I mean, the police in Brazil, it is quite violent. There's so many deaths. I mean, you hear stories every day. So he became like a lot of artists, especially from Globo or a main TV channel. They wanted to associate with the Amarildo cause. So I'm sure you're going to see a lot of Amarildos in the streets. Or Nelson Mandela as well.
Of course, there's something of a reverence in the mask, something of the kind of respect, appreciation and kind of admiration of certain figures. So perhaps we'll see that.
And I just want to say one that I'm pretty sure you're going to love. In 2012, we had a TV, a trashy TV show called The Rich Women in Brazil, which I'm sure you have in all countries. But you have this Brazilian socialite, Narcisa Tamborindegui.
Eu me chamo Narcisa Cláudia Saldanha Tamborindegui, Saldanha da alta aristocracia portuguesa.
She's incredibly funny. She's like one of the most famous socialites in the country. And at some point she rents like a place in the Copacabana Palace and she was throwing eggs on people downstairs. That's caused a lot of controversy. She was the main star of this Mulheres Ricas, which is the rich women show. She was saying a lot of absurd things, but, you know, some people loved her and she released books and she's still quite popular. But
so would we see a mask of Narcisa this year?
No, I think because the new season is not on yet. But who knows for 2015? That could be a guess.
That was our very own Brazilian there, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, explaining the significance of carnival masks to David Pleasant. And this is one of the songs that Carnival Goers will be listening to this year. It's a funk singer from Rio, Valesca Popozuda, with a hit that's already gained cult status, Beijinho no Ombro.
Thank you. deseja todas inimigas vida longa.
Beijinho no ombro, which I'm reliably informed it means little kiss on the shoulders, which is a Brazilian expression for I don't care about my enemies. Fernando told me that anyway. That was Valesca Popozuda. It's almost the end of the show, almost but not quite. As ever, we've got our review segment, and today it's television, and not only TV, but American TV. Alice Vincent, entertainment writer at the Telegraph newspaper here in the UK, joins me in the studio. Alice, hello.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about a new man on an old show in a moment. Mm-hmm. But first, the show that I wasn't going to call it the new Breaking Bad, but just as we were listening to that music, you said some people do refer to it as a new Breaking Bad. True Detective. Why should I care about True Detective? Is this one of those things that in 3 years' time I'll be like, okay, I'll watch the box set?
I think it is, yes. And you can get on now, especially in the UK, and you'll only be six episodes behind where they are in America. I definitely advise people to get in now. It's very cinematic. It's very beautifully done. It's got two massive big Hollywood stars in.
Yes, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. And we've actually got a little clip from the first episode. Let's take a listen.
But you're not a Christian, so what do you believe?
I believe that people shouldn't talk about this type of shit at work.
Hold on, hold on. 3 months we've been together, I get nothing from you. Today, what we're into now, do me a courtesy, okay? I'm not trying to convert you.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
Means I'm bad at parties.
Let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either.
That was Woody Harrelson. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that's Woody Harrelson. You could tell it's Woody Harrelson with Matthew McConaughey there in True Detective. And I think, Alice, one of the things I found interesting about this show is that it's supposed to be about a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're following that case, but it's told in a sort of very sort of complicated way. There's flashbacks. It's you see these two characters twice, sort of back in the 90s and the present day.
Yeah.
But it's also just about the two of them talking.
Yes, I mean, it's definitely, it's the serial killer show for people who don't like serial killers. And the interesting thing
are the people that do like serial killers.
Not well, that's a good point. I missed show off the end of that sentence. but yes, I mean, it is more about the relationship between these two men. And we see them go through 17 years. And you say flashbacks, but the flashbacks really aren't that flashy. It's you only realise subsequently. In many ways, they are playing a very kind of similar portrait of humanity as a whole. That's what makes it so gripping and interesting, I think.
And again, it's an HBO show, so it's which seems to, you know, like all the other HBO shows we love, from, you know, including Sopranos and Sex and the City, it's got that. It doesn't have to necessarily appeal to the mainstream. It can take risks with what it's doing.
Yeah, and I think it is, but I also think that once again, it shows that the golden age of TV is upon us. Got these more Oscar-nominated, massive stars, very cinematic. Screenplay, and that not only are they taking risks, but they're taking risks with something that is film worthy.
Let's talk about something else that's just started in the US. That is Jimmy Fallon taking over the Tonight Show that Jay Leno did, that Conan O'Brien did very briefly. Let's mention Conan because he was good, even if he didn't do it very long. And obviously, famously, Johnny Carson. Now, for people outside the US, it's quite hard to get your head around how a show that goes out at 11:30 and finishes at 12:30 every night can really become a national institution.
Mm. I just don't think in Britain that we get the late night show thing. Late night for us is Jonathan Ross, you know, it's really not the same. But it's very much a hierarchy, it's a way of bringing on new comedians, and you start on the 12:30 and you go down to the earlier slot, and there are connotations with both. So for this is a promotion of sorts for Jimmy Fallon.
Yes, because he was on the late night show, which begins at 12:30, oddly. And he's now been promoted. Let's have a little listen. This is a sketch from one of his early shows this week. It's Jimmy Fallon with Will Ferrell and a special guest star from the White House.
So, like, what's up? Have you been watching the Olympics?
Absolutely. I love seeing the best athletes in the world compete against each other.
What's your favorite event?
Well, I enjoy them all, but one of my favorites is figure skating.
Me too! Same person!
Triple hand hug! Wow, Michelle, you're pretty strong. You could totally be on the Olympics.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I do try to exercise every day.
Really? Because I think exercise is ew.
Exercise is not L. You just have to find an activity.
Not entirely sure all humour travels across the Atlantic. That was Jimmy Fallon with Will Ferrell and Michelle Obama. Alice, it's interesting that, you know, this is the sort of show that, you know, for example, the First Lady will want to be on, because it appeals to a different audience.
Yes, and I think that is one of the things that has, not a bugbear, but it's something that people have been discussing with Jimmy Fallon moving to the earlier slot, because it's watched by more people, it's far more universal, he's got a slightly older audience to look after. And when you're trying to appeal to that many people, you're never going to please everybody.
Well, exactly, and Jay Leno was, you know, criticised by some within the comedy scene that he wasn't cutting edge enough, that his monologues were a bit obvious. But if you are supposed to be mainstream, then you've got to appeal to everyone.
Mm. I think the thing with Jay Leno is that he was a company yes man, and he never really took any risks that other comedians doing that slot had.
But if you're NBC, then perhaps that's what you want, isn't it? Because you know, let's not underestimate how important this is to NBC.
No, it's massive. And so I think so far, actually, Jimmy Fallon's been doing really well for them. They've had the best ratings week in 20 years or something. So it's not all something. It is the best rated weeks in 20 years.
Okay, well, that's not a bad start, is it? Alice Vincent, entertainment writer at The Telegraph, thank you very much indeed. That's it for this for today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Everard and Peter York. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Michaela Aitken. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up, after the news, it's The Entrepreneurs, where we'll find out about bulletproof cars in Beirut and meet the man behind Australian microphone manufacturer Rode.
This is a low-cost product for a video mic, right? It's a $99 retail price. If you work back the margins to a distributor and then to us and our raw costs, it's like, how can you do that in Australia? Well, I'm not going to tell you, but there's some secrets in there.
You might hear some of those secrets in a moment. Stay tuned for The Entrepreneurs. That's after the news. Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow. Tyler Brulé will be sat in this very chair. But for me, thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.